Welcome to Sabbatical 101. My name is Bethany Walensky, and I'm an associate professor at Michigan State University. I had a life-changing sabbatical, and I'm on a mission to help fellow academics do the same. This podcast is a resource for all things academic sabbaticals. Each episode will provide you with inspiration and insight into the sabbatical planning process, regardless of your institution, discipline, length of sabbatical, or where you plan to sabbatical. I'm so excited to have you along for the ride.
My guest on today's episode is Rebecca Roach, who's also known as the Academic Imperfectionist. Rebecca is a senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of London, and she also has a coaching business and podcast, which focuses on helping academics ditch perfectionism. I think you're going to really like this conversation about what perfectionism looks like in academia, what causes it, and how it holds us back as academics. Rebecca and I also talk about how to set reasonable expectations for doing a good enough job, how the culture of academia keeps us in pursuit of perfectionism, and ways to recognize and interrupt that trap, including some helpful mindset tips. I also just want to give you a quick reminder that this is the second to last episode of the podcast before I take a break for the summer. Next week, I'll talk about how to come back from sabbatical, and then I hope over the summer you'll revisit past episodes or read my blog for even more sabbatical ideas and insight. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Hello. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for the invite.
You're welcome. So before we get started with hearing about your coaching business and the work you do as the Academic Imperfectionist, could you just take a few minutes to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your scholarly work?
Yes. So I'm a philosopher. I'm quite a boring philosopher in the sense that I don't have an interesting academic history. It's all been philosophy. I've had a couple of diversions. So I've spent a few years working in business, well, in IT, and then another few years I took off when I had kids. But apart from those breaks, I've been an academic philosopher my entire adult life. And I've jumped around a bit in terms of the research that I do. So these days I'm mainly interested in social and ethical issues relating to language and communication, but I have a fairly short attention span research wise. I've done a bit of everything.
Okay, great. And then in addition to your scholarly work, you're also a coach. So can you tell me a little bit about how you got into coaching and the kind of coaching that you do, who you serve?
Yes. So So this all started a few years ago when I went on a training event at work. So it was an academic event about mentoring. So I was assigned as a mentor for a junior colleague and told that, you know, as is often the way, you'd be given this role, so you have to go on a training course about it. So that was actually quite interesting. And as part of that, the instructor was going through the differences between mentoring and some similar roles, one of which was coaching. And I knew a few people who were coaches, and it just started to occur to me that philosophy, which is my discipline, the tools of the philosopher were probably quite useful for coaching, just because of the way that philosophers really dig down into fundamental assumptions, question beliefs, etc., etc. It just seemed like, you know, being a philosopher would probably be a good way to be a coach. So I was mulling that over for a little while and thinking about maybe I could train as a coach on the side. And I was actually signed up to do some coaching training. And then the lockdown hit and everything was cancelled because this was all these training things were supposed to be in person. And at that point, I thought, well, either I put this on hold or I just kind of jump into it and tell people that this is something I'm trying to do and offer them some free coaching sessions. So it's kind of like I coach them based on my inept knowledge of what this is about. And I get some practice too. So I offered that in some academic Facebook groups I was in. And I expected a couple of people to sort of take pity on me and agree to sign up. But I got loads of replies. So that was great. You know, I ended up doing, coaching every day, pretty much. I suppose a couple of things occurred to me. One was I was right that the training as a philosopher is actually a really good fit for, well, the sort of coaching I do anyway. And also that there's a real need for it. So the communities I'd reached out to about this were mainly women working in academia. And yeah, they snapped my hand off. And the same sort of issues kept coming up. So things relating to shame, guilt, imposter syndrome, anxiety, sense of letting people down, what, you know, the usual sorts of things. So this led me to think about, when I went into this not really knowing what I was going to do with it, it was a sort of thought of initially of this might be a fun spin, you know, another way to be a philosopher.
Sure.
And it kind of is, but I suppose I started taking it more seriously, so, you know, something that I could do, something that I could offer. And that led to me starting the podcast, which is The Academic Imperfectionist. So that in a kind of very broad way brings together, well, it applies philosophical thinking, philosophical analysis and techniques and so on to the sorts of problems that people bring to me in coaching sessions, just because of the thought, well, you know, that there's so much. Everybody turns up to coaching sessions thinking that they're a complete freak, but no, nobody ever experienced the problems that they do. And there's some reassurance in finding that that's not true. I'm sure you find this with your practice. Yes. As well. So sort of using a podcast to address that, you know, sort of, you're not alone. Here's a treatment of the sorts of issues that you're experiencing. And it's just gone on from there. You know, people continue to find me through the podcast, and I do the coaching alongside my, you know, I'm still a full-time academic philosopher, and they really do complement each other quite nicely. I've had coaching work informing some of the philosophy that I do, and vice versa.
That's such a nice synergy. I know from my experience, it's really fulfilling and gratifying to have this side thing that's sort of related to academia. I'm an ethnographer by training, and so I'm just curious about people's lives, and I see people as experts of their own experience. So similar to you, I think for me, coaching is kind of like doing an ethnographic interview. Like, okay, tell me more about that. Let me understand where you're coming from. And it's, yeah, not the mentoring, like, let me give you advice about what you should do, but let's try to figure out what's best for you.
Right. And I don't know if you find this as well, but I feel like a lot of this is sort of self-coaching. I find it, especially with the podcast, it's often advice that I wish I'd had a yes. few years ago. And the whole thing, I've really tackled some of my own problems in an indirect way through trying to help other people. You know, I was actually thinking the other day about, I started working on a new article a couple of days ago, and I've already written quite a lot. And it just occurred to me, God, I'm actually writing okay. You know, I'm managing to write stuff down without weeks of procrastination and anxiety and feeling like it's not going to be enough. And I'm not sure I could have done that a few years ago. So it's a completely win-win situation.
Yeah, there's this self-reflexivity. It's this great opportunity to use the struggles that you've had. And like you said, often we feel like we're the only person having this experience, and that is so far from the truth. So it's so validating just to put that out into the world that, you know, your listeners will listen to an episode and say, oh my gosh, there are other people who are extremely successful who struggle with the same thing. So you call yourself the Academic Imperfectionist, and that's the title of your podcast as well. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So it started, a pushing back against perfectionism was the core idea here, because I felt like that was something that was really holding me back. And I noticed it in other people as well. And I think it's really, there's this sort of vicious cycle between a sense of inadequacy and perfectionism that was really tripping me up. You know, this sense of I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not dedicated enough. You know, I'm just not doing the amount of stuff and the quality of stuff that other people are doing. So therefore, in order to compensate, everything I produce is going to have to be perfect. For a long time, I didn't even realize that was my mode of thinking. it just felt like, I just didn't know. You know, I realized that I had real trouble getting down to work, and I didn't know why. It really was a mystery. And then, yeah, I worked out with the help of a coach and a psychotherapist as well that perfectionism was at the root of a lot of this stuff. So initially, I was going to do a podcast, and of course, it had to have a name. And I was thinking initially of The Imperfectionist. And then my thought was, well, you know, maybe I'm not everybody's imperfectionist, but I at least feel like I've got something to say about academic imperfectionism. So that was the thought.
Okay. I know that you just did a recent podcast episode about this, but I'm curious, what exactly is perfectionism? Could you say a little bit more about what perfectionism is and how you see it getting in academics' way?
Yeah, yeah. This was my 100th episode, 99th or 100th. Yeah, when I realized, well, I've got this podcast called The Academic Imperfectionist. It's supposed to be about perfectionism, and I've never actually said what I think perfectionism is. There's some temptation as a philosopher to try and do a sort of conceptual analysis here. And so like, these are the necessary and the sufficient conditions for perfectionism, which I'm trying to resist. And I try to think of it more in terms of how I encounter this in myself and other people. So, you know, how it shows up in ways that make a difference to the way that people live their lives. So I think there's a few things. I think it is at the root of it, there's a binary way of thinking. So either something's perfect or it's worthless, usually in relation to stuff that we do ourselves. So I know that lots of people I see in coaching sessions, and sort of this is something I deal with myself, there's this thought that if I'm writing something, for example, it's either perfect or it's worthless. And that just leads to, because of course nobody does anything perfectly. So when you write something, if you're someone who struggles with perfectionism, then when you write something and you find a flaw in it, which inevitably you will, then the perfectionist just jumps to, okay, this is rubbish. You know, there's no nuance. There's no, okay, there's this problem with it, but I can work on that and improve it and so on. There's none of that, or at least if there is, we kind of have to work hard at it. You know, it's not what our mind defaults to. We could see the nuance in other people's work. You know, I think with a lot
of
us,
our own worst critic,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we have no problem looking at what other people do and thinking things like, well, you know, this other bit, this bit could have been done better, but on the whole, this is really good. We just miss that in ourselves. So there's that binary all or nothing thinking, you know, it's perfect or it's rubbish. So you miss the value of what's in between. And I guess linked to that is anxiety. I think that's maybe why I'm maybe putting a psychological hat on here, and I'm not a psychologist, but it seems like this is a result of anxiety. There's this sense that I'm worried I'm not good enough. I'm worried that what I'm producing is not going to be even adequate. And that worry causes us to look at things in this binary way. So it almost seems like a sort of confirmation bias. We're worried that we're inadequate. So as soon as we spot a flaw in what we do, then that kind of leads us to think, okay, I was right. I am rubbish. There was no point. I'll just give up now.
Yeah. I think part of what can be so challenging if you're a perfectionist as an academic, and I feel like so many of us are, I think the nature of the academy feeds that anxiety, mm-hmm. right? Because I don't know about you, but at my institution, how you get tenure is a very nebulous idea. No one would say you need this many publications in these journals. So you feel like you're always striving to do enough, but you never know if you've done enough. So I think it feeds that cycle of anxiety and, well, this needs to be perfect because it needs to get into this top tier journal. And then also, our work depends on a peer review process. And so it can be really hard to get criticism of our work. And I think so easy to say, well, the reviewers didn't like it. I guess it wasn't good and I'll just give up on it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I completely agree. It's that sort of difficulty with lack of firm guidance about what counts as good enough. But I think lack of clarity in other respects as well. Things like, you know, what counts as a day of hard work or a productive day. You know, if you work in a factory, you sort of turn up, you clock on, you do your hours and you clock off and that's it. You've done your day's work. But with academia, it's much more difficult. Some of our time will be spent, you know, just in the shower, mulling over ideas, and that can be a big part of the process. And then sometimes, you know, you might set a day aside for writing. This was something I used to really struggle with. I set a day aside for writing and then I just wouldn't know what to write. And I just had this unrealistic expectation of myself that I should be like typing the whole time or handwriting, but, you know, getting words down. But often it's not like that. Writing is about thinking, about all sorts of other things. It's interesting, actually. So I interviewed on my podcast recently someone called Kate Arl, a psychotherapist. She used to be an in-house psychotherapist at university. And she was talking about some of the fantasies that some of her clients used to have about, you know, this is what I'm going to do when I leave academia. And she found that it was often the fantasies were things where you could tell if you'd done enough work or not. So she talks about like people wanting to leave academia and go and mow people's lawns, because you can tell when you're done and you can tell if you've done it correctly, right? It's clear what counts as enough, right? If the grass is short enough, you're done. But, you know, with academia, it's not that. You can think you've done enough and be wrong. I mean, this is what the peer review process shows up, right? You can think, okay, I've covered all bases, and then someone comes back with this really nitpicking report. So yeah, that's tricky. And I also think it's especially in recent years, a big part of academic culture, at least in the UK, is excellence. So excellence in teaching, excellence in research, excellence in everything, which nobody can do, right?
Because you have to be good at everything. Well, yeah, you have to be more than good at everything you do. And there are these very divergent functions. Being a good researcher requires a very different skill set than being an excellent teacher.
Right, right. Yes. And so there's no space in that for a good enough job. Because if you're excellent at one thing, then there's going to be other things that you do that, because you're prioritizing, which is part of being excellent in one thing, you know, there's going to be other areas of your working life where you're going to have to say, okay, good enough is good enough here. Can't be excellent in everything. But that's all just pushed aside. No institution wants to say, okay, excellence in research, but, you know, just do enough in the other stuff.
Mediocre teaching is fine.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, you kind of get to a certain stage where you see through this and you think, well, nobody's excellent at everything. But I think especially for early career people, they think that this is what everybody else is doing except them. And that's a real route into perfectionism.
Yeah, that's so true. This idea that everyone else is working harder than me, everyone else is publishing more than me, or, you know, getting all the accolades. I think about this a lot coming back from winter break. So you come back to work in January and ask your colleagues, oh, what did you do over the holidays, over the break? And people will frequently talk about all the grants they submitted and, you know, all the work they did. And I've made it a point to say, I didn't do any work. You know, I'm right now scrambling to finish my syllabus for the class that starts in a couple of days. But, you know, I took 2 weeks off to just hang out with my kids because they were home on break. And so I think part of it, maybe part of the way we interrupt this is by not buying into that. I feel like another challenge in academia is we don't get a lot of positive reinforcement. Mm. So unless you're the most excellent teacher and you win the university teaching award or something, or unless you get the most prestigious grant or fellowship, there's not, it's just like, put your head down and keep toiling until you get there.
Yeah. And I think there's a thought that we shouldn't need the positive reinforcement, that it's its own reward, which it kind of is in a way. You know, you go into academia, for many people, it's a vocation. Like, you're doing it because you like your discipline, because you like teaching. So it is its own reward. But then there's this sense a lot of the time, I think, that, you know, we shouldn't need a pat on the head every time we do something. And so it's kind of childish, right, if you're expecting that. But it's not. You know, everybody needs to be told they're doing a good job sometimes, right?
Yeah, I realized this. I started my business just a little under a year ago, and I worked with a coach. I was part of this boot camp to start up a coaching business, and he was so supportive, and I got so much positive feedback and reinforcement. And I just thought, this is amazing. I mean, it did tap into my good student tendencies. Mm-hmm. So like that was, I had to be aware of, am I doing this just for the validation and the gold stars? But it felt so good, you know, and I'm a full grown adult, but it felt really nice to have someone saying you're doing a good job, or if things didn't go well, to say, that's okay. Let's think about how it can go better next time. And I was so struck by that, and it just made it so clear. It was such a stark contrast to my, you know, academic life. And I work at a great institution. I have a great department, right? It's not that I'm not in a toxic situation, but it's just, I think, like you said, there's this expectation that the reward is, you know, you got your work out into the world and that's all the reward you need.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to, in years past, I won't say which academic community I'm talking about here, but I was talking about the situation with an academic colleague of mine. And I said, it felt like belonging to this particular community was, it felt like being in a relationship with someone who never says they love you. Mm. Like, some, you know, the fact that, you know, that they haven't left you, shouldn't that be proof enough, right? They tolerate, they continue to tolerate your presence in this relationship. And that's expected to be good. And, you know, nobody was ever saying, great job here, or, you know, really impressed, you went the extra mile. You know, it's kind of like your efforts were never acknowledged. It was just sort of, okay, we're not going to kick you out. And you're supposed to infer from that you're adequate. And you can, I guess, infer that you are adequate from that, especially if other people are being booted out. But it's really hard work. I mean, you don't get that, you know, that warm, glowy feeling that we all need, really, sometimes when you've, you know, when you've gone the extra mile and you want to be appreciated. We all need that, I think.
Yeah, it's nice to be appreciated and nice to feel like the work we do matters. But in academia, there's not a lot of positive reinforcement. And also, we're on these timelines that can be, you know, even accomplishing the goal can be, it's hard to identify when you've done it.
Yes, yes, exactly. So if it was written on a task list with a checkbox next to it, it's sometimes not clear. Can I check this off yet? Have I done it? What does it mean to be done, et cetera, et cetera.
So then if you're a perfectionist or you struggle with sort of perfectionist tendencies, I would imagine that kind of feeds that cycle. Maybe I need to do more. This isn't quite done yet. I'm not really sure what done looks like.
Yes. And there's another thing that goes along with that, I think, which I've called moving goalposts. I don't think that was my term, but sometimes people will set themselves a task and they'll accomplish it and then they'll sort of devalue it, especially if, well, I managed to do this and I'm rubbish, so I obviously wasn't aiming high enough. And then they'll set their sights even higher without acknowledging their own success. So that means that, you know, even sometimes when we do set ourselves quantifiable goals, we don't give ourselves the credit when we reach them, which, you know, that's a way of just teaching ourselves that it's just a thankless task to work towards goals. It's all quite self-defeating, a lot of this stuff, I think.
Yeah. So as someone who is a perfectionist at heart, and I don't even think I'm a recovering perfectionist, maybe I am, I don't know. How do we avoid or overcome perfectionists? Like, do you have any strategies that you regularly work on with your clients? Or maybe you don't overcome perfectionism, maybe you sit in the tension and you find different ways of being.
Yeah, I think a big part of it is accepting perfection doesn't exist.
Mm.
At least, you know, as soon as you start to do something, as soon as you start to work towards a goal, it's imperfect, because this is the real world. It's not this sort of whatever it is, this kind of hallmark academic career that we're living in our imagination. And just so, I think a lot of the time the thought process goes something like this. You know, we start to work towards something, we spot that in some way things aren't going to plan. And that might be in a completely minor way. So maybe you decide that you're going to start work at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning, and you get up at 7 and there's some issue, like the cat's made a mess. That's a particular favorite in my house. So something has to happen and you're delayed by like 15 minutes. So it's kind of nothing, completely recoverable. But then, you start to think, God, things are already not going to plan. I'm already off course. And instead of sort of thinking, okay, no problem, I can just be a bit flexible, things like this happen, I can, so you keep your eye on the zoomed out version of the goal. We just kind of home in and make these things mean stuff that they don't need to mean. So it's all then about, the wheels are already falling off. It's all rubbish. That sort of mindset then becomes the problem, I think.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So kind of getting into your head, like, well, this has already gone wrong. It's kind of like, if I want to start eating more healthily, and then I'm like, well, I had that croissant for breakfast, so now I might as well eat the cake for lunch too, right? You kind of
Right.
Well, I blew it, so I might as well just give up on my goal. So we don't need to see each thing as so meaningful.
Yeah. And I think what's lending the meaning there is just this sort of underlying fear that I haven't got what it takes. I'm doing it wrong. There's that sort of, I'm probably going to do it wrong. And then as soon as something goes not to plan, then that's confirmation of that. I think actually one of the biggest breakthroughs I made in my own significant struggles with writing is realizing that a lot of the experiences I had that are just normal parts of the writing process, I used to view as evidence that I was doing it wrong or that I couldn't do it. So even things like when you sit down at the desk and you're planning to get on with some writing, and it will often take kind of 15 minutes just to sort of ease yourself into it, before you can focus on it, which I more recently discovered that's just how the brain works. You can't just task switch without some lag, right? So that's completely normal. We all need a bit of time to warm up into it. Sounds obvious when I say it out loud. But I would be sitting there in that first 15 minutes thinking to myself, I'm rubbish. I'm so lazy. I can't even think about what I'm doing. I've been sitting here for 20 seconds and I'm already thinking about, what I'm going to have for lunch or whatever it is. And, if you just stick with it, you sort of get past that and you can get into a bit of a flow. But what was happening an awful lot in my case was I wouldn't get past that. I'd just give up. I'd just be thinking, this is really uncomfortable. All I'm thinking about is how rubbish I am. So I'm just going to procrastinate and just going to do something else, which then, snowballs, because then it's more difficult next time to get into it. And that took a lot of time to break down. And I see this an awful lot in other people as well. It's not necessarily always with writing, but there will be some really unhelpful snowballing of thoughts about inadequacy, which get blown out of proportion and then just start being a problem. So it ends up being that it's actually the mindset that is the big problem here. It's not inadequacy at all.
Yeah. And we can tell ourselves, such powerful stories, right? That I think another, like a non-writing example might be, you feel a little bit of imposter syndrome about the course you're teaching. And so you're preparing the lecture and you just keep doing more and more and more because you feel like, oh, the students are going to spot that I am not an expert or that I don't know what I'm talking about. The reality is that even probably if you didn't prepare, you still know more than the students do. And they would not pin you as an imposter.
Yeah.
But once you start telling yourself that, then, you just go down the rabbit hole of hours and hours of preparation when maybe you didn't actually need to spend that much time on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Then there's that thing that I you're reminding me of some uncomfortable experiences I had when I first started teaching. Well, it would occasionally be the case, for example, that a student would ask a question about the material. So they'd be like, what did this philosopher say about this? And they were just being curious. But in the very early days when I was doing this, my mind would be, oh God, they've caught me out. They're trying to ask me a question that I don't know the answer to.
Trying to stump me.
Right. Yes. It's just that sense of inadequacy just kind of acts as a filter through which, you know, everything. It reminds me actually of that. I don't know if you've seen this article from a few years ago on The Onion about imposter syndrome. It's just so evocative of what it feels like. It's called something like "Today's the Day That You Finally Get You Finally Get Unmasked," which is, you know, that's very much, I think, the fear that a lot of people are laboring under.
Yeah, for sure. I've been teaching at the university level for over 10 years now, but I still have to tell myself, it's okay to not have all the answers. My job is not to have all the answers. And so it's a helpful reframing when a student asks a question, some very minute detail that they're focused on for whatever reason.
Yes, I'm similar. So these days, if a student asks a question I don't know, I think it's not only that I've become comfortable with saying I don't know, but also that I will kind of emphasize it because I want them to know that it's okay not to know. Because, you know, if you're presenting, I think, you know, a lot of the time, if you're, especially if you're early career and you're still trying to demonstrate your adequacy, right, that you kind of have to know everything. And, you know, often while we're busy trying to do that, the message that we might unwittingly be sending to students is, I don't know isn't good enough. You have to know, otherwise you're inadequate. And then it's like handing the perfectionism baton to the next generation.
Yeah. And I think we can model that for junior colleagues. We can model that for graduate students. Grad students will invite me to speak at their gatherings or, you know, writing group or something. And I think sometimes they're surprised at how transparent I am with them about my own struggles. Cause I'm like, I don't want you to think that this is just rainbows and puppy dogs all the way. Like there are real challenges, but also I know I have boundaries that I put in place and they're kind of shocked, you know, if I say, well, I decided that I wasn't going to work on the weekend. And if I get tenure and I get to spend time with my kids and be part of my family, then that's great. And if the reason I don't get promoted is because I chose to spend time with my family, then I'm sure I have other skills that I can use in the workforce.
Yeah, but it sounds like something that you are uncovering there is the way that a lot of academic culture, despite all the advances we've made, it's still kind of geared to this vision of the scholar as the man who has a wife taking care of the domestic stuff. So, of course, you're not going to need to spend time with your family because someone else is doing that, right? And so there was that division of labor, right, within the family. And it was not to say, I'm certainly not saying that's what we should be going back to. But I think that's really pervaded the academic culture. I think we're getting better at people saying things like asking for childcare, for example. If you get invited to a conference, like, what are the childcare arrangements? Or organizers of events trying to be mindful of not putting things on in the school holidays, stuff like this. But it's a slow process, and of course, the background assumptions take longer to catch up. So there's still this idea that, of course, you should, if you're awake, of course you should be working. You can't be like making a lunch or something else. You know, I have a real weird relationship with these idealistic views of what scholarly life should look like, because, you know, that idea of the, you know, the ivory tower scholar, where you sort of go off to your study and you just spend the whole day just thinking, ruminating, writing. There's a sense in which I love that and I would love to do it. But the reality is I would just, that much time with my own thoughts, it would just be like an anxiety hellhole. Like by the first afternoon, I'd be thinking, oh God, I haven't done enough. And I think a lot of it, you know, when I think about it, it's kind of like, this is what I wish I could be like. I wish I could just, you know, go off to my attractive book-lined study and just snap straight into flow mode, bash out a fantastic final draft quality piece of work, and then go and have dinner with a completely clear conscience. I've done enough, but I'm just not capable of that on any level. And, you know, even if I did manage to do something like that, I would still be finding some reason to think I was inadequate. So I think, you know, there's this sort of, what am I trying to say here? It's almost like, you know, even the even the perfectionism vision of how it should go is not, if I actually think about inhabiting it, it would just be rubbish.
Right.
It'd just be a nightmare.
What you want. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think a lot about seasonality and the way that we have different seasons in our lives. And we can think about, there might be a season where you are so focused and you're able to go shut yourself in your office for 5 hours at a time and work. Maybe you'll have a season like that in the future, right? And so I think we can be honest with ourselves about where we are and what makes sense, but then also be open to other realities being possible in the future. Not that kind of ideal, everything has to be perfect, but well, this isn't something for right now, but maybe a version of that would be possible somewhere down the road.
Yes. And that there's a sense of, it's kind of like meeting yourself where you are.
Yeah.
This is something I've heard yoga instructors say. You know, sort of you can't just like look at what somebody else can do and beat yourself up for not being able to do it. It's sort of about, okay, there's your capabilities and what a good outcome for you looks like is not necessarily what it looks like for another person. So this year, as I said, I'm on research leave at the moment. And I think at the moment I've sort of realized a good day for me can look like maybe 1 or 2 hours of writing, by which I don't mean like solid typing, just in case my earlier self is listening to this and thinking, God, I'm incapable of that. But, you know, just putting a decent effort in, sitting there, thinking, writing, looking stuff up, not spending too much time looking at nonsense and going down wormholes. So, yeah, if I can do that for an hour or an hour and a half, say, then I can't really expect more. I could get other less cognitively demanding stuff done, but I can't get more writing done. And I've noticed if I can be comfortable with that and not tell myself that I'm not doing enough, then I can get up the next day and do it again. And I think I can sort of spot the traps that I've fallen into in the past where, you know, if I were to fall into the trap, which I think I could very easily, if I let myself of thinking, oh God, you know, there's people out there working for hours on end, you know, doing an 8-hour stint, writing. And, you know, what a lazy sod I am. I'm not doing anywhere near that. If I were to do that, then the next day I wouldn't be able to get up and do it again. I would be avoiding it and I'd just be an anxious mess. So I think a lot of the peace that I've made with myself here is about being realistic about what I'm capable of. That it's better to be, if I can get, say, on average, an hour and a half of writing out of myself while I'm on research leave, so not while I'm teaching and have other responsibilities,
sure,
then it would be much less. But if I can do that every day and be kind to myself about it, then I'm actually going to be a lot more productive in the end than if I were, you know, prodding myself and saying mean things to myself. And this is just something that lots of people I see in coaching sessions don't realize. They think that they need to be constantly cracking the whip and that that's the way to get results.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point that you're essentially creating this positive feedback loop that is really motivating, saying this is my goal, it's very realistic, and then I can feel good about it when I've accomplished it. And I feel like this is a great model for a sabbatical like this. I'm going to write for 1.5 hours a day, and that's great. And then you can stop there. Because I think also sometimes it's like, well, I wrote for an hour and a half, I have to keep going now. And then that can also be counterproductive. Maybe you do want to, but you can also say, that was enough, I can feel good about it, and then I can do it again tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. It's about the long game, I think.
Yes. Well, Rebecca, this was such a great conversation. And I think there are so many things that will benefit the listeners of this podcast in thinking about the intersection of perfectionism and sabbaticals. And as you're preparing for a sabbatical, recognizing if you have some of these tendencies. And I think a sabbatical is a great time to try out different mindsets and different habits. And it could be a great time to try to break that cycle of perfectionism.
Yeah, it's been a great chat. Thank you.
Where can folks find you?
So you can find me at academicimperfectionist.com. That's my website. It's got a link to my podcast. And it's got a way for people to get in touch with me as well. I'm not so much on social media these days.
Probably for the better.
Yes. I mean, it's a real double-edged sword. You know, that there was lots that I found valuable about it, but it is a huge distraction for me. I've been moving a little bit into Medium in recent weeks. I'm trying to write a blog post to accompany each podcast episode I release, but I'm still a bit of a newbie there. But if anyone wants to find me there, you can look me up there and I'll be happy to hear from you.
All right. Sounds great. Well, thanks again, Rebecca. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks, Bethany. Lovely to meet you.
I hope you found this episode of Sabbatical 101 helpful and inspirational as you think about your own sabbatical. If you want to read more about sabbaticals or get even more support for planning your own life-changing sabbatical, head over to my website, www.bethanywalinsky.com, to read my blog and for more information about my sabbatical coaching program.